Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and we're delighted to have you with us today. And we have Robin Martinez also co-hosting this show. Hello, Robin.
Hi, Joyce. How's everything with you?
Doing great. I'm getting a little feedback on your line. So can you make sure that there's not a microphone and a speaker that's too close to each other?
Shouldn't be. That's odd. Okay. So
anyway, we have a wonderful guest with us today who has been very active in the empowerment of patients. And we've talked a lot about becoming a partner with your doctor and trying to really be a more active player in your healthcare. So we're interested to hear his own perspective on it from his own journey. So good morning. This is Jack Aiello from San Jose, California. Hi, Jack.
Hi, it's very nice to be here.
Great, it's good to have you here. So I understand you have quite a patient journey yourself.
Yeah, I'll be happy to share a bit of it. It started 21 years ago when I developed a severe backache, except that x-rays and MRIs didn't show anything out of the ordinary. And after 2 months of excruciating pain, whether I was sitting down, lying down, walking, whatever, the orthopedic doctor said that, well, let's try something called a myelogram. And a myelogram, they take a blood test 1 week, and then the following week they inject some dye down your back to get a better look at what's going on. And I took that blood test, and in that intervening weekend, my back stopped hurting, and it hasn't hurt in 21 years. And I went to the orthopedic doc and said, we can skip that test. I'm out of here. And he said, wait a minute. The blood test, I still remember the words. He said, the blood test showed you have an elevated protein, which to me sounded pretty good. And he continued to indicate I have a cancer. And that's where you kind of stop listening. Called multiple myeloma, which I had never heard of, so it didn't matter much if I listened to that either. And that's kind of how my story began. I remember being, I thought, smart enough to ask him just two questions. In fact, one, I made him write it down. How do I spell myeloma? And he wrote it down on his business card. And two, since I felt really good for the first time in a couple months, I asked, what's single myeloma? Maybe I don't have it as bad as whatever multiple myeloma was.
Yeah.
And you laugh, but I thought it was a pretty sensible question, but it turned out
it is.
It is,
actually.
And I left his office and looked up some information and kind of confirmed what he had said to me, that there was no cure available for myeloma and a couple of treatment arms. But the average lifespan once diagnosed and treated was about 2 or 3 years. So that's how my journey began. Would you like some more information about it?
We're sure glad you exceeded the odds.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's interesting because doctors don't usually like to predict that anymore, because either it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and people go, oh, well, that's my expiration date, so I'll make it true. Or they say, damn it, not me, and live way, way beyond that. So it's very interesting how one's will to live also plays a role. But, I mean, obviously, that's not the total end of that story, because you did do some stem cell transplants and some other pretty intensive treatments to get where you are today.
Yeah, the only treatment arms available back then were oral doses of melphalan and prednisone or a transplant arm. In the case of myeloma, nearly all transplants are what are called autologous. They give you a high dose of chemo and beforehand harvest your stem cells. After that high dose, they reinfuse those stem cells into you to hopefully rebuild your immune system, which has been destroyed by that high dose of chemo, and build things back up. So the transplant today is still often used for patients, and typically, again, on average, but everybody differs, on average, patients will get 3 or 4 or 5 years of remission. I have a good friend who had a similar transplant back in 98 and hasn't had any treatment since. And
wow.
For myeloma. And I, on the other hand, had 2 of these transplants right in a row and only got 1.5 years remission. So after that kind of failed, in my opinion, I went on to some clinical trials and nothing was working. I was requiring blood transfusions frequently. And at the end of 1998, I had a 3rd transplant, except this time being what's called a full allogeneic transplant. That means that those stem cells that rebuild an immune system comes from a donor. In this case, it was my sister. And for myeloma patients, that transplant isn't done very much. It has a high mortality rate just from the transplant, anywhere from 30 to 40 to 50%, depending on who you ask.
Mm.
But it was the only treatment option left for me. And while it resulted in 2 or 3 years of graft versus host disease and some other side effects, I've been without treatment and in a good remission now for 15 years.
Fantastic.
But when you say without treatment, do you mean no maintenance treatment either?
That's correct.
Wow.
No maintenance at all. Maintenance was used in the mid-90s. Something called interferon was given to patients, but that was shown pretty much not to work. Then there wasn't any maintenance used.
They're now doing quite a lot of maintenance for auto patients.
That's right.
Stem cell transplant plants.
That's right. But the drugs they're using weren't invented back then.
Right. And they use the lighter doses of the drugs rather than the full treatment doses.
Correct. And they still are studying the benefits of maintenance. Should you these days be on maintenance for a certain length of time? Should you be on maintenance till your disease comes back? What's the preferred dosages and the actual drug that gets used? So, yeah, maintenance is a big deal now, but it wasn't when I finished that 3rd transplant because those newer drugs weren't the first one wasn't developed and approved until 2003, but fortunately for myeloma patients, we've had 10 drugs approved through last year. None are curative, but all give you more treatment options to help manage the disease through the whole phase of first treatment through maintenance.
And
so
it's amazing how much the landscape has changed in those years.
Yeah, and it becomes that much more important for patients to become educated and become their own best advocate when it comes to their own treatment.
Exactly. So even though there are lots more options today, and we don't need to go through the details because anybody who's embarking on this journey obviously needs to be talking to their own medical team. But I think the other message that we really want to explore here is how important is it that the patient become part of that team? So tell us how you managed to become more involved, become empowered in the course of your own treatment.
If I look at what was the best thing for me that ever happened, I was introduced to a support group that was offered by the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society when I was getting my first chemotherapy in a hospital, and I dragged my IV pole to this meeting begrudgingly. By the way, I didn't feel like I wanted to go to a support group, which I thought was kind of a touchy-feely kind of thing, and that wasn't my bag. But I was convinced to go, and I listened to different patients introduce themselves and their diseases. And then one guy named Jim said, I have multiple myeloma. This was back in 95. And Jim, first of all, it was really important for me to see someone living and breathing with the same disease that I had.
Mm-hmm.
And second, he introduced me to some resources from a nonprofit organization that supports myeloma. The International Myeloma Foundation had started back in 1991, and they had literature on their site at that time. You have to remember, the internet wasn't as robust as it is now.
Right.
And Jim also introduced me to a myeloma-specific group that we had in the Bay Area, where 20 to 30 patients would attend our monthly meetings. And you really learn a lot from patients, not necessarily how the medicine might work and such, but you learn what questions to ask your doctor. And that gets you going into kind of becoming your own patient advocate and being smart about asking those questions. And today I facilitate that same Bay Area myeloma support group. So even though I'm not on treatment, it's dependent on me to still stay very much in touch with the treatments that are now available to patients.
That's great. So the word advocate has a Latin root that means sort of talking for. And so it's like a mouthpiece. So if you advocate for somebody, you speak up for them on their behalf. And in this case, we're speaking up for ourselves. So tell me how you were able to approach your doctors, and especially at that time, how receptive was the doctor for you asking those questions and wanting to know medically flavored answers?
So I was pretty lucky. The first doctor I was assigned, I think I'd gone to a support group, and I then came back and asked the doctor, how many other myeloma patients are you seeing? I figured one with more experience is better than one with less experience.
Mm-hmm.
And when he said only two to me, that was a trigger for me to look around for another oncologist, hematologist, which I found. I interviewed him just the same as if I was going to hire someone. I asked him that question, and he said he was seeing a dozen. And to me, that felt like an order of magnitude more experience. Plus, he had graduated from Stanford, had connections there. And subsequently, I mentioned that I did that transplant. I did it in Little Rock, Arkansas, which back then was one of the few myeloma centers in the country. And my local doctor was very encouraging for me to get second opinions, go get transplants at Little Rock. And subsequently, I have local doctors at Stanford now that Stanford is stronger in myeloma as well. But I was always grateful for that doctor never making me feel like I shouldn't be asking him questions. Now, he talked really fast. So I would go into our meetings with a pad of paper and questions already answered. And I would write down his answers. And I wouldn't allow him to look on my paper for the next question until I was done writing. And he was willing to put up with me.
That's great. Yeah, some doctors are resistant to those kinds of things. But my experience is that the doctors who are worth the investment are going to be willing to put up with you.
Yeah, and I will tell patients, if a doctor is reluctant to agree that a second opinion would be valuable, then the first thing I would do would be drop the doctor. You really have to be in charge of your clinical team. And I think, and the good news for myeloma patients, at least, is there are a lot of myeloma hematologists, oncologists, and experts out there that are awfully good and great to have on your team.
That's great. And you said you were interviewing him as if you were hiring him. And the truth is you were hiring him. We actually do have the right to hire and fire our doctors.
We do. He was a little bit balding and gray hair. So I also kind of asked him, tried to be polite about it, but I asked him, so how long do you intend to be practicing? and he told me, I have kids in high school. I have to be working for at least another 25 years, which he did. He just recently retired. So that's the same thing. I mean, I didn't want to develop a relationship and then see him go away in 2 years.
Somebody said, you know you're getting old when the doctors and policemen start to look young.
That's probably true. That's probably true.
So, Robin, you work with a number of people with myeloma and related conditions. What kinds of things would you want to know about Jack's journey?
Well, Jack's journey really parallels a lot of the SMART patients who have gone through this. And then when we get newcomers, they need to be brought up to speed. A lot of them think that just because somebody has hematologist as part of their title, that they're an expert in myeloma. And that's not true. Hematology oncology is the general name of the specialty. So practically every oncologist can be called a hematologist oncologist. And helping them find the right questions to ask, the way to ask them, where to look, who to talk to, how to use the resources at International Myeloma Foundation and other websites, how to choose a good resource as opposed to a bad resource. All these things are things that members are teaching each other, and it's a fantastic place to find out, to start from the beginning and find out what you should do to be a SMART patient.
I would certainly agree with that. When I talk with, and I talk often with newly diagnosed patients, we recommend that patients check out the online SMART Patients form, which allows questions to be asked and answered. We encourage them to check out the International Myeloma Foundation, the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, all whom provide webinars and blogs and videos that patients can learn from. There are seminars around the country where multiple doctors will attend and provide information. So unlike 95 when I was diagnosed, there's a wealth of information out there. A bit of a problem with the myeloma community is that the average age of diagnosis is 69 years old. So you have a lot of people diagnosed in their 70s and 80s that aren't able to get around that much, aren't necessarily able to get on computers. And it can be difficult to help them because it can be difficult for them to find information. Hopefully they have caregivers. It can be sons or daughters. We deal a lot with that, who will translate and find information for their parents and be great caregivers for them.
Yeah, that's very true. A lot of times the caregiver is the one who has to do the information gathering because the patient is too sick and is focusing on the disease itself and getting better.
Jack, are you involved in advocacy with research teams at all?
I am. I'm a committee member for certain committees. The National Cancer Institute, NCI, has a steering committee for myeloma that I'm on. One of the National Clinical Trial Networks group called SWOG has a myeloma committee. I'm patient advocates on both these committees where These committees develop and approve clinical trials for myeloma. And I'm asked to represent the patient's voice there. What will, for a clinical trial, what will it mean to have results from that trial for a patient? What, how easy or difficult might it be to accrue patients for that trial? What might be the cost, if any, that should be paid for, not by the patient, but by the pharma company, for example? And I sit on a steering committee at Stanford as well, and a couple other committees. So I'm very much involved in the research arm, where I enjoy talking with the primary investigator on concepts of trials and seeing them through completion, which is typically many years down the road.
That's great, and that's really an important function.
Yeah, a lot of people think that clinical trials are something that you hold off on and don't go into until you've exhausted every possible avenue of approved treatment, and that when you go into a clinical trial, you're going to be a guinea pig. And we have tried to help people understand that that's not really true, but could you give us your perspective on that, Jack?
So you're right, Robin. There are many barriers to accruing patients for clinical trials. They are at the patient level, and they can be also at the doctor's level. Patients may think they're going to be guinea pigs until they realize, and you hope they give it a chance and do realize, the fact that trials, you're not guinea pigs. You are either given, if it's a randomized trial, you're either given the standard of care or another drug plus the standard of care. That's typically how trials are designed. You are, within a trial, watched very carefully. So I, as a patient, would rather have more frequent tests than less frequent tests to monitor if this new drug is working or not. Patients, I mean, it can be a burden to be in a trial if it's not necessarily offered where you live locally. So that would have to be considered. And then doctors themselves. I mean, if I have a local oncologist that isn't offering a clinical trial at their facility, they may be reluctant to make it known that that trial's available. They may also feel that, like you just mentioned, that, well, we'll just try the standard of care for a while for this newly diagnosed patient, rather than looking at a trial for a newly diagnosed patient. So there are barriers which we are always trying to overcome, but it's, again, a difficult thing to get to that patient. There are sites that all the trials are listed on a government site called clinicaltrials.gov. But those advocacy organizations I mentioned, the IMF, the MMRF, and LLS, all have contact points within their organizations to specifically talk about what trials might be most effective for a newly diagnosed patient, as well as a relapsed or refractory patient where treatment is no longer working. And anybody listening to this as a patient, I would really encourage to contact them or find a local support group who are also quite familiar with or can be familiar with trials as well.
And if you're willing to travel particularly, it's always a good idea to either use a database or contact one of the professional societies and say what's available, because your local doctor is likely to think, oh, you want to stay in state or you want to be at this facility. And so they'll tell you about what they may know about, but nobody can off the bat know every clinical trial that's recruiting in the U.S. and what their requirements are and what they're looking at and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, the good news, if you go to clinicaltrials.gov, for example, is you, if you do a search on myeloma, you'll find thousands of trials. If you do a search on myeloma and a particularly new drug you might have heard of, you'll find fewer trials. And for any of those trials, you can look at the locations of where those trials are being offered.
Right, so you can even search by location.
That's right. So you can learn more and more about clinical trials on your own, but like I said, there are organizations that can help you get through that maze of information.
And that's really a big help.
Great. So maybe, Jack, you can give me the websites after we finish the conversation, and I'll put them in on the webpage for your show so that people can find them more easily. That'd be great. Thank you. Great. So we talked about advocacy for the patient, him or herself, advocacy for research. What other things are important for people to at least be aware of, if not becoming involved in?
Well, there are a couple other types of advocacy. One is legislative advocacy. It can be done both at the state and federal level. It's interesting to do it. I've done quite a bit of it. And if you get a chance to meet with legislators or their staff, they are, number one, always interested in meeting with their constituents because you hold the key to their success, namely a vote. And they are interested in talking with you as a patient versus a pharmaceutical company that's coming in as a lobbyist. I think they appreciate hearing patient stories. So, for example, over the last few years, with a number of these oral therapies coming out, it can be very expensive, even if you have insurance, to pay for these oral therapies, unlike the infused or drip therapies, which are covered by different insurance plans. And so the last few years, both at a state and federal level, legislation has been put in place to try to have insurers pay the same for oral therapies as they would infused therapies. And state by state, they have started to put caps on some of the insurance plans to make oral and non-oral therapies equivalent. It's not on a federal level yet. There's a bill being proposed and co-sponsored currently that will come up to the floor for a vote at some point. And you as a patient, you as a caregiver, can get involved. Any one of those sites that I mentioned, especially the International Myeloma Foundation and the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, you can join their advocacy groups for this type of legislation. They'll keep you well informed in terms of what relevant legislation might come up and put together a nice template email for you to embellish maybe with your story. And it's easily then emailed to your particular legislator. It can be taken a step further because these organizations will sometimes take groups of patients to Washington, D.C., or arrange for groups of patients to their own state capital and call on their congressman or congresswoman to make a point about trying to pass certain legislation. I gave you the example of the one of oral parity, but over the years there have been many others, whether it's just to increase the National Institute of Health / National Cancer Institute's budgets for researching cancer, or other individual bills that can help. And while there's a cost in doing that, I always say to the legislature, just imagine if we were cancer-free and what the long-range productivity gains would be if we didn't have to spend all this money on cancer treatment. So
that's right.
And we lose all this time.
Exactly right. And then these organizations, especially the nonprofits, depend on fundraising. They will lead and fund clinical trials on occasion. They will also educate patients, but it all comes from fundraising. And I've been active in fundraising for myeloma, as have many other patients. And it's easy to get involved in that stuff. You can, I hold, for example, an annual poker tournament that raises several thousand dollars. And I participate in a 5K event that's occurring this weekend, actually, in San Francisco, and raise tens of thousands of dollars for that. And I know where the money goes, and it's awfully important because that's how we advance treatments. We advance them to have clinical trials completed and be able to look at new treatments for patients when old treatments no longer work. And maybe one day a cure for myeloma.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. And we're going to be winding up the show here a little bit, but I wanted to just remind everybody that whatever condition you're dealing with, you care more about that condition than probably most people on the street. So, you know, getting involved in letting people, letting the researchers know why it's important to you, letting your legislators know what works and what doesn't work for you around the system and the reimbursements and all that stuff. If you just share that with people, it will give them more context and hopefully they'll make the decisions that work better for you and for other folks in the same boat. Robin, is there anything that you wanted to add before we wind up?
Who have a disease or who are dealing with somebody who has a disease, their father, their mother, their sister, brother, spouse, child, are going to have to become advocates for that person if they want the best results.
Great.
And being an advocate, I mean, it feels good to give back. I mean, to share your information that you've learned with others that are newly diagnosed, and it just feels good to help others. And by the way, you meet a wonderful group of doctors and nurses and such. And so I find it a very positive role.
That's great.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much. And I'm glad you screwed up your courage and went to that first support group meeting, Jack.
Yeah, I am too, actually.
That's great. Well, thanks so much for being with us today. This has been very wonderful. And thank you, Robin, as always, for being with us. And thanks to everybody for joining us today. And we hope you'll be with us again next week. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. Take good care.